and then we're going to move on to some things that we still need to talk about. In our previous classes, we've talked about identifying certain passages and being familiar enough with them that we know where they're found, even though we may not be able to quote them. We know where to look for them. Now, the reason why we're doing that is I'm confident that many of you know passages. You can quote them or come close to quoting the passage in full. But when the question is asked, where is that? Now, you may be thinking about a passage when you're in a Bible study with somebody, and if somebody asks you to show that to them where they can read that in context, you say, well, I know that's in there somewhere. It's in the New Testament. Well, that's not hardly close enough. And even if you say, well, you know, I think that's in the book of Acts, it may or may not be, but the book of Acts has 28 chapters. It might take you a while to find it. So what I want you to be able to do is to know where these passages are found. Be familiar with the context. And those of you who are younger are going to be the ones I'm going to pick on a whole lot tonight. So you pay attention. In our study tonight, I want to notice there is a passage that says that it's not in man that walketh to direct his own steps. Little David, where is it? No, it's the other one. Jeremiah. Where? 23. Jeremiah 10:23. Daniel, there's a passage that says there's a way that seems right unto a man, but the end is death. Excellent, excellent. Jonathan, there's a passage that talks about Nadab and Abihu. Now, I know you hadn't been here, but you were there when we started this back about 2 years ago. So, where is the passage that discusses Nadab and Abihu?
Numbers.
No, you're close.
The priest.
Talking about the priest.
Chapter 11.
It is. No, it isn't. No, it's not in Numbers, and it's not chapter 11. Help him out, Carolyn.
Leviticus 10,
1 and 2. There's a passage that talks about King Saul. Bruce, you're not one of the young folks anymore, but I'm going to have you do this one anyway. It's an ongoing thing with Bruce and I. He's only, what, 11 months older than I am? Well, we're not going anywhere. There's a passage that talks about King Saul. Where is it, Bruce?
King Saul.
How that he was told to destroy the Amalekites and he didn't do it.
1
Samuel, yes.
See.
It's a big book. 1 Samuel what? Help him out, Peggy.
15,
yes. 1 Samuel 15. There's a passage that discusses King Uzziah. Katie, where is it? King Uzziah, who offered incense, and of course he was not a priest. He was not authorized to do that. Help her out, Amy. Yes, Al? Yes, 2 Chronicles 26:16. That's right. What happened to King Uzziah, Katie, when he went in there to offer incense and he wasn't supposed to? You remember what happened to him? John, what happened to him? David, what happened to him? He became a leper. He died a leper. That's right. There's a passage that says, not everyone that says unto me, Lord, Lord, shall enter into the kingdom of heaven, but he that doeth the will of my Father. Sarah? It is? Amy? 7:21, beginning. And one of the interesting things about that is, in that context, listen carefully, in that context, there were those who came and said, in that day. Now, what day was that? Day of judgment. In that day, they would say, did we not cast out demons? Did we not prophesy? Did we not do many mighty works in thy name? Now, evidently, in the day of judgment, here were some who thought the things they did were by the authority of Christ, but they were not. Jesus said, depart from me, I never knew you, ye that work iniquity. What does the word, Megan, iniquity mean? That's right. Which tells us that though they thought these things were right, they were works without law. They were works that were not authorized. There's another passage that says, why call ye me Lord, Lord, and do not the things which I say? David? Oh, the word iniquity means lawlessness, without law. Therefore, the things they were practicing were without divine authority. David, why call you me Lord, Lord, and do not the things which I say? Where is that?
21.
No.
7.
No. Now, I messed you up, didn't I? See, he was anticipating that I'd ask him the same question night after night, and this is a different one. Where is it? Anybody?
6:46.
Luke 6:46. All right, there's a passage that says, "Whosoever goeth onward and abideth not in the doctrine of Christ, Jonathan hath not God."
2 John 9.
Boy, he's right on that one. And there's a passage that discusses our relationship to the law of Moses. To the law of Moses. Emily, give me any passage that comes to mind that tells us that we're not under the law of Moses today. Hebrews something. Yeah. Well, that's a good place to start. Let's just start in Hebrews 1:1. What does that say? All right, Hebrews 1:1. What does it say, Jonathan? That's pretty good. In time past, God spoke to the fathers through the prophets in diverse portions, different portions and different amounts. But he hath in these last days spoken unto us in his Son. In his Son. Which tells us we're not under the law and the prophets. We're under the law of Christ. There's a passage, Betty Jo, that says, let me find it. And this is the one, David, you thought I was going to ask you. Enter in by the narrow gate, for wide is the gate and broad is the way that leads unto life. No, broad is the gate and wide is the way that leads unto destruction, but narrow is the gate and straight the way that leads unto life. Where's it found, Betty? Enter in at the narrow gate. It is Matthew. Yes. Was that just a good guess, or did you just have an inkling? Yeah, okay, it is Matthew. Help her out, Katie. You remember that? How about you, Daniel? All right. Megan. Enter in at the narrow gate. For wide is the gate and broad is the way. Little David. You got the verse. 7:13-14. Good, good. There's a passage that describes Jesus with Moses and Elijah appearing before him. Where is it? Anybody? Indicating that we're not under the law. Moses and Elijah are not God's spokesmen today. All right, we're going to stop there because I want to talk with you about some other things, and I'm going to run out of time if I don't. We're talking about Bible expediencies, scriptural expediencies. In order for a thing to be a scriptural expedient, it must facilitate in the accomplishment of God's will and be in harmony with God's Word. Now, sometimes we get that all mixed up and we think, well, if it helps us, then that makes it an expedient. Not necessarily. It must aid or facilitate in doing what God said and be consistent with what God said. Now, in our last study, we looked at these verses, and these are some I want you to put on your list. These are passages I want you to remember. In order for a thing to be lawful, it must be expedient. We've noted in 1 Corinthians, I didn't say that. In order for a thing to be expedient, it must first be lawful. See, I got that turned around. In 1 Corinthians chapter 6, verse 12, and the same thing essentially stated in chapter 10, verse 23. Paul said, "All things are lawful to me, but not all things are expedient." It's crucial that we notice in that context that Paul is not saying everything universal is lawful. While we know that's not so, we're not permitted to just do everything, and there are some things that God tells us to do, some things He tells us not to do, so we've got a perimeter on this. Within that perimeter of things that are lawful, Paul said not everything is expedient. It might be established as lawful. Now, how do we establish something as lawful? All right, direct statements, approved apostolic examples, and necessary inference. Anybody got a rubber chicken? I'm going to whack him. I got one in the office, you know. All right, yeah. direct statements, approved apostolic examples, and necessary inferences. Now, once we've established the practice to be lawful, then we determine whether or not we are allowed any judgment in carrying out those things, or whether or not God has been very specific about those things. Now, we illustrated that regarding the building of the ark. God told Noah to build an ark, and he gave him the kind of wood it was to be built out of. He gave him very specific dimensions. But we noticed that encompassed in the accomplishment of the dimensions, there had to be some kind of measuring tools. Would it then be lawful for Noah to use measuring tools? Would it be expedient? Why, sure, because he's using them to do the very thing that God said do. And when he uses measuring tools to build the ark, is he adding anything to or taking anything away from what God said? Now that becomes an interesting tool that we want to think about. Did it add anything to or did it take anything away? Now in our discussion last time, we've noted that sometimes we think something facilitates when in fact it is not consistent with what God's Word says. Now there are some that become nuts on this point. They think because abortion is wrong, then it's all right to bomb an abortion clinic. Well, that's wrong too. So it's not expedient to do that. There are some, and I noticed just recently, there are some who think, well, women might have a greater influence over a certain population, so therefore it's appropriate for us to have women preachers. Now that's not to speak disparagingly of females, but the point is, God said who is to do the public speaking, didn't He? God said that. Now when He said that, then we add to. It's not expedient for us to add to that. That becomes something that is an addition to what God said and therefore unacceptable. When we talked about David transporting the ark, we've read these passages. And we saw how the Philistines transported the ark on a cart pulled by cows. But when David tried to return the ark of the covenant, to the city of Jerusalem, to the temple, he tried the same means to do that. But we find that Uzzah put forth his hand to steady the ark, and what happened? He died. And David learned why. Because we did not seek God according to the ordinance. That we weren't successful at doing that. So he then told the priests to sanctify themselves and prepare themselves to carry the ark on their shoulders just like God had told them. Now we might think it'd be a whole lot easier to roll that thing along in a cart pulled by cows than it would be to carry it on our shoulders. We say, well, that'd be a whole lot easier way, and sometimes we equate easy with expedient. They're not the same thing. For what David did was contrary to the law of God. It was not lawful. Now, in order for a thing to be expedient, it cannot be specified. We talked about this briefly also in our last study. When God specifies something, the choice then is obey or disobey. When God told Noah, go for wood. Now, the choice was to obey or disobey. God specified the kind of wood. And we've illustrated that regarding our singing in worship. In fact, we spent a good bit of time last time. We'll not reiterate all of that. But we noted that to sing and to make melody in our hearts is the means by which not only do we praise God, but we teach and admonish one another. And so as far as music and worship is concerned, God specified the kind. Now expediency in human wisdom involves the right of choice, but it's the right of choice within the perimeter of those things that are lawful. Now we've got to see that. We've got to see that. If God specified something and I want to step outside the circle and do things that He hasn't said anything about, then I'm not operating on the premise of that being expedient. It's not expedient. It's sinful. It's unauthorized. Now, we see and have illustrated that when God told Noah to build an ark, which log of gopher wood? Now, he's got a choice. Which male lamb that meets all the other specifications regarding the sacrifice of the Passover? Which songs will be sung? Now God said sing psalms, hymns, and spiritual songs. I understand that. But there are a lot of psalms, hymns, and spiritual songs. Now do we have the choice of which one that we sing, provided they teach the truth? May we sing in four-part harmony, or do we all have to sing soprano? You see, that's a matter of expediency. It doesn't make any difference. That's within the realm of judgment that God has granted us. Those things are authorized. Now, if we go beyond by providing an instrument of music, that's not an aid, but that becomes another kind. And by the way, I'm going to ask you this. Did any of you happen to watch some of it was this morning, what they called a prayer meeting of the inaugural stuff that was going on? Any of you see any of that? One of the things that I noticed about that is in the building where they had that, it's a historic building, but they had an organ in there that was just fabulous. But the pity of it was you couldn't hear any of the singing for the organ playing. You couldn't hear what they were saying. Now, one of the things that kind of impressed me about that is the simplicity of what God said. God says, sing. Now, you can spend multi-billion dollars on an organ, and it's still not the same thing as singing. It's an addition. It's not an aid. It doesn't aid or assist in carrying out the command to sing, but it becomes another kind of music. It's outside the circle or the class of kind that God had specified, and therefore it is going beyond. I want you to notice regarding the subject of being baptized. This is something we talk about a lot, and it's a very simple subject. But the command to be baptized, what does the word itself mean? Joey? No, you can't do that.
Okay.
I already passed that point.
I had a discussion years ago with a guy. He said, well, we are obeying that command to sing. We're doing it with a piano.
Mm-hmm.
But the fact that we have a piano doesn't mean we're not singing. We're singing.
Mm-hmm.
We're just doing it with a piano.
Mm-hmm.
So the point that needs to be emphasized, like you said, that's actually an addition. But singing with a piano, if I can make an analogy, that would be like Noah building the ark out of, yeah, gopher wood. He used gopher wood, but only on the left side. On the right side, he used pine.
Yeah, yeah.
So yes, he used gopher wood.
Yeah.
When God said use gopher wood, he didn't mean partly. He meant the entire ark.
Yeah. You know, there's a word here that's missing in some of these argumentations that we often hear, and that little word is the word and. Folks want to include that word and, which when I was in school, that word was a conjunction, and it tied two things together of equal import. Now, that little word and is just not there. It doesn't say sing and play any more than the word baptized means to immerse and sprinkle. It just don't. Now, when we look at that word in the Bible, where Jesus gave instructions to the apostles to go preach the gospel to every creature, go and preach the gospel. You notice that little word and. We can't just leave that out. That's in the Bible there. Go and preach. I want to know something, Jimmy. Could the apostles do what Jesus told them to do if they just went into all the world and didn't preach anything? Well, no. Well, now let's just suppose, Carolyn, for argument's sake, that they preached the gospel, but they only did it there in Jerusalem. They didn't go to the uttermost parts of the earth. Would they have done what Jesus said? Well, no. Now, how do we know that? Because that little word, and, it ties those things together of equal import. They can't remove either one of them and obey the Lord. Now, when we come to the next statement, he that believeth and is baptized shall be saved. Now, there are folks who say he that believeth is saved. Or he that is a believer and is saved should be baptized. But now we're getting that little word and all torn up and tied to the wrong thing. Jesus said, he that believeth and is baptized shall be saved. We understand that. But Joey, the arguments that some are making regarding instrumental music is that we can sing and play. Well, now here we just stepped over the line. And this is the subject that we're talking about. Divine authority is established not by God's silence, but divine authority is established when God speaks. Now, if we're going to find whether or not God is pleased with mechanical instruments of music in our worship, we're going to have to start with some passage. Got to start there. And we don't have an argument if we don't have a passage, do we? You got to start with a passage. Now, if somebody's going to make the argument that we can sing and play, let's start with the passage that teaches it. Let's start with the passage that even smacks of that or even hints at it. And then we've got something to talk about. We can examine the passage and see if indeed that's what it teaches. But until we find one, what do we do?
We don't do that.
We respect the silence of God. Now, interestingly enough, we've already traced the history of mechanical instruments of music in worship. And we found, supported by all kinds of scholars, that during New Testament times, it was not used. We found that mechanical instruments of music was not even used in denominational religions. Until what year? About so. About the 600s somewhere. Now a lot of people don't know that. If you don't know that and you want to study the history of instrumental music, there's a whole lot of tracks right back there in the track rack called Instrumental Music in Worship. And there's a rather exhaustive study in that track on the history of instrumental music in worship. It's a great track. I would encourage you to pick it up and read it. Then you'll know. You'll also be familiar with some of the arguments that are so-called used to defend instrumental music in worship. But let's talk about being baptized. We find that the command to be baptized is a very simple one. We've noted it in Mark the 16th chapter. He that believeth and is baptized shall be saved. We see what baptism is, and this is a passage you've got to remember. What baptism is in Romans chapter 6 verse 4. Let's see, John Grigowski, would you read that for me, please, if you know it, quote it. Romans 6, verse 4. All right, that's 1 Peter 3:21. Very good quotation, but it's from the wrong passage. Excellent job. All right, we're buried. Very good. So the passage teaches us then that baptism is a burial. You are buried with Him in baptism. It's interesting to me to note how that word is used in the Bible. The same word, baptizo. It's translated in Luke the 16th chapter. When you read there of the rich man and Lazarus, you remember what the rich man said to Abraham about what he wanted Lazarus to do? What did he say, Bruce?
He said, you take
that's it. All right, now I want to correct you on that. He didn't say stick your finger in water. What did he say?
Dip
it in water. You know the word translated dip in our English translation is from the word baptizo. Same word. Immerse. That's what the rich man wanted Lazarus to do. Immerse your finger in water. Now what did he want him to do? Baptizo. What did he want him to do with his finger, James? Put it in the water. Submerge your finger in the water and touch my tongue. Now I find that just altogether interesting when we look at some of these other passages where the word baptizo is transliterated with the word baptize. Now what that helps us to understand, a translation and a transliteration are two different things. Just like a translation and a paraphrase are two different things. Now some of you, I hope, aren't reading from a paraphrase. Because if you're reading from a paraphrase, and you'll find it in the beginning, if you'll look at that page right up there before Genesis, it'll tell you what it is. It'll tell you if it's a translation or if it's a paraphrase. Now if you're reading from a paraphrase version, it's just some man's understanding of what he thinks the English said. Now that's all that is. It winds up being closer to a commentary than it is a translation. It's not a translation. Paraphrase. A translation takes the Greek word and assigns the English word to it. But what we find sometimes, even done in our English translations, is a transliteration, where it takes the Greek word and assigns to it letters that are equivalent, but only in the English alphabet. And baptizo does that. Basically, it assigns the English alphabet to the Greek alphabet, and so you wind up with a Greek word that you can read in English. I wonder why they did that. Carolyn?
Well, otherwise it'd be all Greek to all of us.
Well, yeah, but there's another reason, Randy.
Because when the King James Version was translated in 1611, baptism had already come to mean sprinkling and pouring.
Yeah.
And immersion.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so the translators decided to chicken out and not put immerse or dip in there. They just put baptize.
Well, that's right. And so what we find in Luke 16 is the same word, but it's translated there. You know, it'd be kind of hard to say the rich man wanted Lazarus to come over here and baptize his finger. You see, that wouldn't work so good. But that's what the word means, to dip. And we see it in that passage. Well, as we talk about other supposed modes of baptism, where somebody says, well, we want to sprinkle. Now, the history on that you'd find interesting if you'll go back and study that a little bit. I don't want to take all of our time to talk about that. But there was a man that was on the bed of affliction, and this was called infusion, where they would pour water over him. And so the man who was sick, very sick, some thought he would die. But the man wanted to be baptized. And so they thought it was too harmful to his health to put him under the water, so they just poured a bunch of water over him. Well, that later became shortened to just pouring a little water, sprinkling. Now, interestingly enough, the man who had water poured upon him got well. And guess what he did? He was immersed. Now, he knew that wouldn't do it, so he was immersed. Now, you can study the history of that on your own. But what we want to see in this is a very simple point. The word that God used regarding our obedience is to bury, to dip, to plunge, to be baptized. Now, when somebody comes along under the circumstances that we just presented and said, here's somebody that's sick. He's very sick. So we can't put him under the water. So what we'll do is just sprinkle a little water on him. After all, it's more expedient for us to do that than it is to risk his life by putting him under the water. Now, you see, we've just misused the word expedient. It doesn't become an aid. But now it has become a substitution to what God said. And therein lies the problem. We can't do that. Now, if you think that's not real, I had a personal experience with that right here in Lancaster. There was a man who was a member of the church, in another city from here, whose brother was up here in the AB hospital terribly sick. In fact, he was dying. And his brother had been trying to teach him the gospel and had brought him along to a certain point where he thought that his brother should think about obeying the gospel. But he wasn't in town. He was on his way, and he wanted me to go see the man, so I went to see the man, and yes, he wanted to be baptized. We tried to talk to the nursing staff, tried to talk to the doctors, and they said, if you baptize him, it'll kill him. So why don't you just take him and put him in the shower? My reply to that was, I don't want to get him clean. I'm not going to give him a shower. I want to try to save his soul and baptize him. Now, I know you have facilities here where you have therapy pools and so forth. We can baptize that man. They said, no, we're not going to allow it. That kind of shocked me. But you know, the irony of that was his brother came into town and got all over me and fussed at me. He said, my brother's dying. Can't you just do that instead of putting him under? I said, now, I'll tell you what, I won't have any part of that. If you want to do that, that's not what God said, but I'm not going to put him in the shower. I won't do it. Now, we can't substitute for what God said, even under what we might conclude our dire circumstance. Can't do that. Because that's not expedient. That's an addition to what God said. That's not an aid. That's a transgression. And we'll not do it. Now, if we respect the divine authority of the Scriptures, we can't do that. Now, God specified the oversight. Yes, sir. I'm going to whack you. You wait till I get to the next point. Go ahead.
One can use the symbolism that's described in Romans 6:4 to make the very real point that if you try to baptize by sprinkling or pouring, you've completely ruined or decimated the whole symbolism and the meaning of
right.
It's analogous to a burial, and coming up out of the water is analogous to a resurrection to a new life.
That's right.
And you completely decimated that whole meaning and purpose.
Yeah. Picture's gone. That's right. Picture is gone. And you see a similar circumstance in Colossians chapter 2, beginning at verse 12. The issue of circumcision, that you are circumcised of Christ. Well, certainly you see in that passage, baptism again is described as a burial. All right? Well, let's look at this chart for just a moment. The local church.
You have a lot of colons in there. Which should be colon, which should be semicolon?
Well, there should be a semicolon right there, Richard.
All right.
So you be sure and correct that right there. Okay? But what we want to learn in these passages is that the organization of the local church, God has authorized, and He's told us what that is. In Acts the 14th chapter, in verse 23, we see that elders were appointed in every church. Now think about it. Why do you suppose that elders were to be appointed in every church? Every church is supposed to have them. Well, yes, if we have men qualified and we have the maturity there, yes.
That's God's
That's God's design. Yes.
You see, it's
doing better.
For each congregation to be autonomous.
That's right.
Otherwise, he would have mandated elders over multiple congregations, which he didn't do.
That's right. And we're going to talk about that in a little bit. I got a chart on that and show the validity of your very argument. Very good. Very good point. Yes. In Acts, the 20th chapter, as the Apostle Paul is rehearsing the things that he did in the city of Ephesus, he's meeting with the Ephesian elders. Now, Ephesus was about a day's journey from Miletus. And so he called the Ephesian elders over to the city of Miletus to meet with them. And when he talked to them about the work that he had engaged in among them, he told them, tend the flock. Take heed to yourselves. And he said to do what? To oversee the flock of God over the which the Holy Spirit hath made you bishops. Now, does that mean they can oversee a church over here that they've not been made bishops of? Now, you put that together with 1 Peter chapter 5. And by the way, these are on your list. If you hadn't written them down, you better remember them because I'm going to ask you. In 1 Peter chapter 5, you'll notice at verse 1, the Apostle Peter speaking to the elders. And he said that he was a fellow elder. And he told them in verse 2, tend the flock of God which is among you. Tend the flock. Now that word tend is the verb form of another word that's translated pastor in Ephesians chapter 4, verse 11. So these men who are elders are to pastor the flock of God which is among you. Tend the flock of God which is among you. Now, could these elders exercise responsibility over some other flock? No. Because we see that God has given the organizational structure of His church. Now, I've heard this argument made. If you haven't, you're going to hear it tonight. But there are folks who've made this argument to me. Small congregation. We don't have elders, but we know this large congregation over here that's just a few miles away, and it has good qualified men serving as elders. So what we'll do, because we don't have elders, we'll just take a portion or all of our treasury and send that over there and let those good men oversee our money. Now their argument was, see, we don't have elders, so it's much more expedient for us if we just let those men oversee our funds. Now that's just silliness. We find that these elders, according to the plan of God, were to oversee the flock of God which is among them. Now you want to change that and let elders oversee the work or monies of another congregation. That's not expedient. That's to change what God said. Now I want to look a little further in our charts for just a moment and notice that regarding the evangelism work, we've got a whole other lesson. In fact, the next lesson, lesson number 7, we're going to cover this in great detail. But we see that the church is described in 1 Timothy chapter 3, verse 15. It is described as the pillar and ground of the truth. Let's see. Jonathan, you're an engineer. What's a pillar?
It's a structural support.
It is. It's something that upholds and supports. John, you're an engineer. What's the ground or the foundation? It holds up the pillar. I'm glad we got engineers in here. The church is the pillar and ground of the truth. Now, what's the job of the church, Randy? You're not an engineer. But you know that. Hold up the truth. Now, does that mean that the church has the responsibility of evangelism? Supporting the truth. Preaching the truth. Upholding and defending the truth. That's the job that the church has. Now, that by definition, it is the pillar and ground of the truth. Now, back a number of years ago, Richard, you're familiar with this history. There was a man who believed in principle that the Lord's church was just not going to be successful in doing that throughout the world unless they created some kind of a larger structure through which that work could be done. Now, that was seen in secular realms. If you want to have a great work that's being done, you got folks down here that are a little on the totem pole, and if they just funnel all their monies up the ladder, you see as it gets to the top, you got quite a lot of money. And the thinking of these men back in the 1800s was, that's what we'll do, and that will help us or expedite preaching the gospel throughout the world. Now, we read a few weeks ago from a debate called the Odie Briney debate, where J.B. Briney was defending that very position, that proposition, and trying to defend an organization that was called the Missionary Society. The Missionary Society. His defense of that is, it is expedient. It's expedient for us to do that. Well, what had he done to the organizational structure?
He just trashed it.
Yeah, he just threw it out the window. Now, when we see the organizational structure of the Lord's church, it's local. Each church was to have elders. Each group of elders was to oversee the flock that was among them. Now, that builds a perimeter by divine authority around the work that local elders are to do. Elders are not to expand their work beyond the work of that local congregation. Can't do that. Now, any of you ever played dominoes? I'm not talking about playing the game dominoes. I'm talking about playing with dominoes. You set them up, and you make all kinds of figures, and then you knock the first one over, and then what happens, Katie? Ding, 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 ding. They're all around the board. They all fall over. Now, let me ask you a question. If a group of local elders can engage in this kind of oversight over multiple congregations, what then happens if those elders are wrong?
Everybody's
wrong. You've got the domino effect. But if we recognize the plan of God, that each local church is to be overseen by their own elders, if those elders are wrong, who does it affect?
Just that
one church.
System of checks and balances now.
That's right. You've got just that one church affected. He sure was, wasn't he? He sure was. Now that's good. He sure was. John? Yes.
You always hear about the government spends $200 on a hammer, and everyone's like, yeah, right. I've seen it. I believe it.
Yeah.
I really do.
Yeah.
How's that much for all the overhead?
Well, now, I've never really been associated with an organization that large, but as you know, I grew up on a farm. And we had a similar analogy. If you've got something that's got a lot of wheels, it sure takes a lot of grease to grease all the wheels. Well, we understand that, don't we? Yeah, well, let's look at the next point. In order for a thing to be expedient, it must edify. Now, this is a very important point. What does it mean, David, to edify?
Build
to build up. Let's turn to the context of 1 Corinthians chapter 10. 1 Corinthians chapter 10. Now, you'll notice in 1 Corinthians chapter 10 that this is the second time in the book of 1 Corinthians that this same subject is addressed. In 1 Corinthians chapter 8, he's talking about whether or not to eat meat sacrificed to idols and our relationship one to another in either doing or not doing that. Now, in 1 Corinthians chapter 8, he points out it doesn't make any difference to God whether you eat meat or not. He don't care if you eat meat or if you're a vegetarian. It doesn't make him a bit of difference. You see, that's just a matter of judgment, personal judgment. Now, you can read that in 1 Corinthians chapter 8. But Paul said, if by eating meats, I cause my brother to offend his conscience. Now, we're going to talk about that in the 10th chapter. And to offend his conscience, very simply, is to do something that he believes is wrong. It may or may not be wrong, but he believes it's wrong. Now, if I, through my influence, cause him to do something that he believes is wrong, Paul said, I won't eat meats now and forever. Won't do it. Why? Now, that's the subject that we want to talk about in the 10th chapter. Look at your Bible at 1 Corinthians chapter 10, beginning at verse 23. Paul writes, "All things are lawful, but not all things are expedient." Now, we noted that a while ago, didn't we? Now, we know that he's not talking universally about all things being lawful. But within the realm of things lawful, not everything is expedient. He says, "All things are lawful, but not all things edify." Now, again, within this realm of things that are lawful, not everything builds up. That means within this realm of things that are lawful, we may have some choices. But among those choices, there are things we ought not choose because they don't build up, they tear down. Now look, if you will, at the next verse, verse 24. "Let no man seek his own good, but each his neighbor's good. Whatsoever is sold in the shambles, eat, asking no questions for conscience' sake." You go down to the marketplace, you buy some meat, eat it. Don't ask any questions about where it came from. You eat it. It's meat. You pay for it. You eat it. However, he says, in verse 26, he says, "For the earth is the Lord's, and the fullness thereof." But he says at verse 27, "If one of them that believe not biddeth you to a feast, and you are disposed to go, whatsoever is set before you, eat, asking no questions, for conscience' sake." Now, if I invite you over to my house, and you think that eating ham is a bad thing, you ought not eat ham. Well, if I know that, then I'm not going to serve you ham. But let's suppose you don't have any problem with eating ham. Your problem is, where did you get that ham? Pardon me? Costco. All right, let's just use that analogy. Suppose you believe that eating ham that came from Costco is sinful. Now you come to my house and I serve you ham. Should you ask me, did that come from Costco? No. You just eat it. It's ham. You eat it and be happy you got ham. All right? In verse 25. "But if any man say unto you, this has been offered in sacrifice, eat not for his sake that showed it, and for conscience' sake." Let's pause again. Chris believes it's wrong to eat ham that came from Costco. So I invite him over to my house to eat ham. He don't know where it come from. But he sits down at the table, and the first thing I tell him, "Chris, you know, this came from Costco." He's going to back up. "I can't eat that. Now, what did I do to you?" Yeah, now he's got a problem having to decide whether he's going to let me lead him to eat ham or whether he's going to oppose it, consistent with his conviction, you see.
Or what you eat and think you're wrong doing.
Yeah, you see. So we got a real problem now. So this writer says, "If any man saying to you, this has been offered..." Well, back up to verse 27. "If one of them that believe not biddeth you to a feast, and you're supposed to go, whatsoever is set before you, eat, asking no question for conscience' sake." Now, when you come to my house and you see ham on the table, are you supposed to ask me, "Where'd you get that ham? Did that come from Costco?" No, you see. Now you got a problem, you see. But if you come and eat the ham, you don't have any conscience problem with it if you keep your mouth shut. Now look at the next part of the verse. No, well, see, this is his point. Whether or not it's been sacrificed to the idol is irrelevant. It's just meat. So if you're invited to somebody's house and they set meat before you, don't ask if it's been sacrificed to an idol. Well, something like that on this point. Now, that won't work on everything. Because God don't care whether you eat meat or whether you're a vegetarian, you see. So eat it. Don't ask any questions about it. But, verse 28, "If any man say unto you, this has been offered in sacrifice, eat not for his conscience, or for his sake that showed it, and for conscience' sake." Now, do you see that, Betty? If I invite Chris over to my house to eat meat, he's to eat it, not ask where it came from. But let's suppose I invite him over to my house, and all of a sudden somebody spouts out, "You know, that's been offered to an idol." Chris believes it's wrong to eat meat that's been sacrificed to an idol. And you see, we got a problem here. I'm either going to insist that he eat it, or I'm going to eat it in front of him, and one of us is going to commit sin. Now look at the rest of the verse. Paul asks an interesting question. He says at verse 29, conscience I say, not thine own, but the other's. For why is my liberty judged by another conscience? Anything wrong with eating meat's been sacrificed to an idol, David? No, God don't care whether you eat that meat, where it came from, doesn't make any difference. But if I find out that you have a conscience problem with eating the meat that's been sacrificed to an idol, perhaps this has something to do with your past, and you associate eating this meat with the worship of the idol, and I find that out, what am I to do? Respect your conscience. Now, Paul raises the legitimate question, why is my liberty? Can I eat meats? Can I eat meats that's been sacrificed to an idol? God don't care about that. Then why is my liberty governed by your conscience? It's your problem. Why do I have to change my practice?
It's because of verse 24. It says, let no one seek his own good but that of his neighbor.
All right.
It's a matter of practicing the love of Christ.
It is. It's a matter of practicing the love of Christ. Let's just read the rest of the verse for time's sake. Verse 30. He says, if I partake with thankfulness, why am I evil spoken of for that for which I give thanks? Wherefore, therefore, ye eat, or whether therefore you eat, or drink, or whatsoever you do, do all to the glory of God. Give no occasion of stumbling, either to Jews, or to Greeks, or to the church of God, even as I also please all men in all things, not seeking mine own profit, but the profit of the many, that they may be saved. Now verse 1 concludes that thought, be ye imitators of me, even as I also am of Christ. Can you imagine putting a stumbling block before somebody? Something you know that they're going to have a problem with. Now it may be a point of irrelevance, whether God cares or not is beside the point, but if it's something that He doesn't care about, but you insist, I'm going to hurt you with this, I'm going to make you decide, why would I do that if I care about you? That's right. Terry, you had a comment a while ago. A thought? Question? Okay. Well, we see this. And that becomes a very legitimate question. Now, this idea of conscience only works in certain realms. It only works actually in one realm, and that is in the realm of judgment. That is in the realm of all things being lawful. But yet in that category, you may make some judgments. Now what if God don't allow you any judgments? For example, let's suppose that Chris over here, he is of the conviction that when it comes to the observance of the Lord's Supper, that observing the Lord's Supper upon the first day of the week just seems kind of irreverent. It makes it seem as if it's just commonplace. And so we really ought not do that weekly. We ought to make that something that's really a standout thing in our life and spread that out. So we ought to do that once a year. Or maybe we can get him to concede that we can do that maybe four times a year. Now that's his judgment on that. But do I have to surrender to his conscience on something like that? James?
No, Jesus said this too, and the example is that the church met on the first day of the week and they partook of the Lord's Supper.
All right. Now we find in Acts the 4th chapter a biblical illustration of this. We find that we're to be in subjection to rulers, are we not? We can read that in Romans 13. But yet we find certain rulers in Acts chapter 4 commanded the apostles not to speak or teach any more in the name of Christ. How did the apostles answer that? We must obey God rather than men. We cannot but speak the things which we've seen and heard. Now you see where God has limited the perimeter. I can't respect Chris's conscience on something like that. I have to do just what God said.
That's not right.
That's right.
No.
No. Oh, by the way, if you don't have lesson number 7, they're up here. There are a few more lesson number 6. We need to get to the questions on that. Right there, I need to eliminate that colon. That got confusing to Richard. Yes.